Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger. I'm joined, as ever, in our New York studio by Citywire RIA editor Ian Wenick. And today we have a very special guest. Ritholtz CEO Josh Brown joins us from his spare room. Correct, Josh?
Yeah, not my bedroom, but a bedroom.
An incredibly tidy bedroom, I have to say.
Well, you should meet my wife.
Yeah.
She opens birthday cards over the garbage can. We're very tidy.
That is very tidy. That would she would last about 30 seconds, I think, in my house with my two young kids.
Yeah.
Josh, I don't know if you want to share with the listeners very quickly, because we've got a lot to get through. But why are you why have you ended up recording in your spare room?
Yes. So in the pandemic, I had to get out of my house and I couldn't go to Manhattan because the city was shut down. So a friend of mine owns a strip mall and was nice enough to let me take over a former hair salon and convert it into like my little pocket Long Island office. And I kept it. It's been 6 years. But it's in a strip mall. So it's a plate glass window is the front. And 2 weekends ago, somebody accidentally drove through the front of the place right into the building. And fortunately, it was a Saturday. Nobody was injured. But I am temporarily displaced, a situation that I am in the process of remedying as we speak.
Amazing. Well, I'm glad, obviously, everyone's safe and that you...
Yeah, super amazing. I was worried it was some sort of Final Destination kind of thing where I had cheated death at some point and it was still chasing me. I'm not 100% sure how to feel about it, but obviously nobody was injured is the most important thing, and I will sort myself out.
Excellent. Well, we're glad you're okay, and we're glad you're here today. Now, the idea was you were going to come on and talk about a post that you made, effectively a take that you put on LinkedIn, maybe elsewhere, broadly entitled "The Steroids Era Is Over for Financial Advisors," and there's some really good points in there, sort of a fun take, and we were going to kind of get into that a little bit. But we have all been scooped by the news that Vanguard is buying Altruist. So, Ian, do you want to do the 10 seconds on what the story is, and then we'll pivot to Josh to get his take? And you said in pre-record, Josh, you thought it was the biggest story of the year, so we'll unpack that a little bit.
So first, shout out to our booking department for securing such a great guest. It's me. I'm the booking department.
Well, you could have had Jason, but you have me instead.
So the news, which broke literally right before we started taping, is that Vanguard, second largest asset manager in the United States, household name even to people who
in the world, second largest in the world.
Yeah.
You have to check the numbers.
No,
right?
It is second largest. It's got to be up there. It's second largest in the world for sure.
He's right. BlackRock, Vanguard.
Yeah.
He's got it.
Has agreed to acquire Altruist, upstart RIA custodian. We've been writing and talking about them for probably 6 or 7 years at this point.
They've had a banner year as well. We'll come on to that. But definitely, if one was to measure their, this is the wrong phrase, the column inches that they've won this year, headlines, they've definitely been prevalent this year. Okay, so the deal is, a Wall Street Journal's reported they're paying $4 billion, or the deal's worth $4
billion? About $4 billion, and that kind of broadly tracks. So when Altruist did, I believe it was a Series F in 2025, the company had an enterprise value of about $1.9 billion.
Okay. Excellent.
And for some context, Vanguard's invested.
Hey, guys, I have a scoop within a scoop. It's actually $4.6 billion, and the journal has it wrong.
Nice. Okay. Well, by the time this podcast comes out, we will have written that correctly in our story, at least. So, Josh, your insight here is this, because you're a shareholder, correct, in Altruist?
I am a shareholder. I am an advisor to Jason and the board, and I am a user. We are a power user of Hazel and the custodian platform. And I guess you could say we've become evangelists. And you know, I'm happy to talk broadly about what it means for the industry. But just personally, I met Jason Wenck, the founder of Altruist, for the first time at an event we threw in Arizona called WealthStack. And that was 2019. So that's, it's already 7 or 8 years ago. And
were you there, Ian?
And Jason, no, I was not.
And Jason had a tiny little booth and he showed up all by himself and no one had ever heard of Altruist. And a lot of technology companies that service the wealth management space were there in force and on stage and doing demos. That's the event where Patrick O'Shaughnessy rolled out Canvas direct indexing for the first time. Jason was sort of like just in the corner by himself. And that's where the first time I met him. And it's unbelievable what he's accomplished between then and now. So for me personally, to watch an entrepreneur who's done an amazing job helping advisors be better at their jobs, that's gratifying. Obviously, I'm going to make some money personally on my investments. I'm happy about that. But then the bigger picture is, what is it like the future and how we'll work with Altruist going forward? I spoke with Jason this morning. Basically, the way this is going to work is he's re-upped. He signed on to continue running it. You will not see him at T3 next year pitching an AI note taker. Jason is going to continue the work. That was really important for me to hear. His whole team as well. And they're staying in California. So Altruist is not relocating to Pennsylvania.
They're not going to Valley Forge.
Yeah, and I think they're going to get they're getting a lot of investment from Vanguard, and Vanguard wants them to parity or better the incumbent platforms. Vanguard is not jumping back into RIA custody to be fourth or fifth fiddle. I think everybody understands that. And you know, Jason's directive is keep going. It's going great. So from our perspective, we've got clients on the platform. We are actively onboarding accounts every week. And now, for anyone who's never heard of Altruist, well, allow us to explain. It's wholly owned subsidiary of Vanguard. So there's a lot of other stuff around the deal that we can get into. But for me, the important points were my clients, my firm, our strategy, Jason. And all of those things are in place.
In terms of – sorry, there's two follow-up points that I want to get into, which would be, yeah, so what the deal means for the two firms involved a little bit more, and then also what it means at an industry level. So maybe let's stick with the firms involved for the time being. So you mentioned that, you know, Vanguard's not doing this to be, yeah, like you said, like, you know, fourth, fifth in the RIA custody business.
No way.
The main – without sounding sort of too sort of dumb about it, the main benefits the Vanguard gets from this deal.
So having not spoken directly with Vanguard about this, other than a congratulatory email, I think we all understand the importance of distribution. And, you know, Schwab uses its custody platform to its advantage on asset management and distribution. So does Fidelity. So does Goldman Sachs. This is obvious, par for the course stuff. I was on one of my podcasts, I think a week or two ago, saying I cannot believe Vanguard is not in RIA custody. Like I couldn't. Now, had I known,
did you know 2 weeks ago? Would you have known?
I had no idea until today, like everyone else. But Vanguard has a board seat at Altruist, and they're an equity shareholder, so they know what's going on at the business better than anyone else in the industry. And I think this year was a watershed moment for Altruist, where they started to bring, or last year, let's say, we joined as customers last summer. So I think Vanguard looks at larger RIAs, more established RIAs coming on, in addition to the younger, faster growing RIAs, and they just looked at it and said, you know, why wouldn't we do this? What are the reasons not to do this? And it's hard to come up with one. They get this cutting edge AI platform in the form of Hazel that some of the fastest growing RIAs in America are now standardizing on to operate their firms. They get the platform itself, the assets under management and that business, and they now have a direct conduit into the RIAs that either use Vanguard asset management products currently or might be interested in doing so in the future. So I see nothing but upside from the Vanguard perspective. And now they have a new narrative about Vanguard and tech. Now we don't have to have conversations about, you know, their former entry and exit from the space. Now it's like, wait, Vanguard owns Hazel. Vanguard owns Altruist. Like, Vanguard has the best digital onboarding in the entire industry in one transaction. So yeah, I think from their perspective, that's worst to first, what they get. There.
And obviously Hazel, a massive part of this. We saw earlier this year. I mean, I know it came out last year, but we saw, was it sort of, is it February, March? February, wasn't it?
I think it was February.
It was just sort of the week after the software sell-off off the back of Claude, then the Hazel, it was a press release really, wasn't it? But it really sort of went round and round and round, and we saw obviously that sell-off that it caused in Schwab, LPL, whatever, and sort of listed asset or listed wealth management and wealth management adjacent firms and stuff. So obviously that, I assume, is a massive part of the story.
Yeah, the operations people at my firm, the client service associates, the people that make the firm go. So not just advisors, but they're being trained on the Hazel, like Hazel and Altruist for the last 9 months to a year. And I think what ends up happening is you build workflows around this technology, and it makes it really sticky. And it makes it so that look, the typical RIA does not want to invest the time and energy training and retraining and retraining and constantly shifting. Okay, now we use this. Okay, now we use that. Now we use that. It may not have a financial cost, but it has a time cost, which arguably is more valuable. So I think from the perspective of Vanguard, they're looking at this and they're saying, okay, all of these RIAs, they may not be the $400 billion roll-ups, which I know we're going to talk about later, but these are firms that are growing 100% year over year. And these are the future giant firms. And they are starting to coalesce around this platform and standardize on its technology. So it's sort of, look, could Vanguard build something like a Hazel itself? No, they don't. You need to have, we're in this industry where Michael Kitsis has the technology roadmap. And how many logos are on that sheet now? It could be a thousand.
Yeah, it scrolls forever, that page.
Oh,
yeah.
That one. Yeah.
It could be a thousand. So what Altruist has done is they've said, look, no offense, none of these will work as well via MCP or API connection as a custodian that builds the tools right in. And so look at all these point solutions that are masquerading as companies. It's like, all right, we created this amazing thing where we can ingest PDFs and we can use machine learning to read what the PDF says. But all right, we'll just do that too. So it's like one point solution after another being built directly into the Hazel architecture. And if you own an RIA, you're not looking for more vendors. You're looking for less. And the most annoying thing is when your vendors don't communicate with each other, or the APIs break, or somebody makes an API change and invalidates three of these fintech things that you're paying for. So I think the idea that we're going to have 5,000 point solutions, and everyone's going to want to manage these connections with scotch tape and glue, that's a very 2010s idea. And so I think in the 2020s and beyond, the idea is like seamless. And so that is, to me, the value of what Altruist has built for advisors.
And that's great. Thanks. And Ian, very quickly, just to bring you in, what's your take in terms of like what this means now for rivals effectively? So to Josh's point, what Vanguard had, or what Altruist offers and Vanguard now owns is very compelling. How does that impact, say, the other incumbent custodians and or anyone else to sort of look, you know, trying to rival both Altruist and Vanguard?
Well, so I think one thing that we've kind of talked about before and we will talk about is the kind of effective custodial oligopoly that exists. You could argue it's a duopoly between Schwab and Fidelity, although Pershing would kind of beg to differ. And I think that, you know, in light of what we'll talk about later, there are a lot of advisors who probably want another alternative. And I think as Goldman has kind of shown, that it's not just having a lot of resources that's needed to be put in place to actually build out a real custodial unit. I think that what helps is that Vanguard is a private company and, you know, its track record is patience. And so I think that Vanguard is one of those firms that they can afford the how much it'll cost to actually build this platform out, where eventually it will be able to service some of these mega RIAs, and it can become a real look. We'll talk about the other elements. I mean, look, you know, Vanguard has a lot of the same capabilities that Schwab does: money market fund, asset management. I'm also kind of curious to see how kind of Vanguard's existing capabilities will get integrated into this, and also, you know, we'll see how much appetite these guys have for launching bigger breakaways, because that's kind of what Goldman is, I think, moved to pursuing. Is Goldman hasn't really tried as much recently to add established firms, move existing assets over, but they have moved more aggressively to add breakaways and add new assets from well-established firms.
Excellent. Well, look,
that's a great point. And just to build on that, sorry, Alex.
No, go
when we started with Altruist, we made a list of all the things it can't do that we're able to do at other custodians. And that list is shrinking. And a really great example of that is one of the big things that we've been doing for the last 5 years is custom indexing. And our preferred partner is Canvas, which is owned by Franklin. And again, Canvas was O'Shaughnessy. O'Shaughnessy sold the Franklin. Okay. So, you know, Jason says, well, I have direct indexing too. It's native to the platform. We built it. And we're kind of like, yeah, but our whole operating system for allocating these accounts is working with the Canvas people, and we love it. We love the portfolios. We love the service that we get, et cetera. One day it's like, hey, we made a deal with Franklin. We're good. You could do Canvas on Altruist. It's like, you know, Jason, very nonchalant, no press release. He's just like, yeah, we could do it now too. What happens now if Vanguard decides that they want to invest, like seriously, and I'm sure they do, seriously invest in reaching parity or better? To Ian's point, it's a new horse race, and Goldman's in the race and Pershing's in the race. Everyone's in the race. But I think for the advisor community, it's really cool because Schwab is awesome also. Fidelity is awesome also. Like, they have unbelievable capabilities, and our clients on those platforms are very happy as well. So having these firms trying to outdo each other to bring new technology in and make the advisors' lives easier, I feel like everybody wins, including the incumbents that are being pushed to invest more and work faster. I think it's a win for the clients. I think it's a win for firms, for individual advisors, for the service people. Like, we should have a horse race.
I want to, a little part of me wants to talk about Vanguard and its sort of track record of acquisitions and sort of newish CEO and where that's going. But I'm conscious of time, and we've got a whole other take to get through, Josh. So maybe there's a sort of neat-ish segue here between sort of, you know, you saying things are looking, you know, this horse race, this competition around offering better service, better tech for advisors, that's only good. You also have a take that you posted, a day ago, 2 days ago, I'm not sure, on this. So I'm going to read this out. I told my firm, we are now witnessing the end of the steroid era for financial advisors. So let's get into this, right? There's three.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun. This is good. This is good. there's three main bullet points that you've got here. So can we take each one at a time, and then we'll sort of reflect back at the end? So I'll run through the three quickly, and we'll get to the first one. So the first one is based around the whole sort of list and rankings. I love this line. The whole list and ranking scam is coming unraveled. The second one is around sort of rising rates and the impact that's going to have on, you know, acquisitions, roll-ups, and where they go from here, which is something we've talked about a lot on this podcast. And then the third is the story about Schwab upping the referral, the AUM threshold for the referrals story that we broke on citywire.com/RIA, one of the best URLs in the business. And yeah, so... And what that then means, and sort of, you know, how that's not going to sort of help RAs anymore. So let's get into it. Let's start with the first one, if that's all right. So, Ian, do you want to give us like the 10 seconds on what this story is about? And then we'll pivot to Josh to explain the impact.
So basically, I'll make a baseball analogy that Josh will understand, but you will
baseball
not.
Baseball analogies, I have to pretend to
Which
know.
Is that if we're talking about the steroid era, then you're basically like Frank Thomas in 1994, 1995. Calling this stuff out before people actually heard about it.
Okay, thanks.
He gets it.
Barry Bonds. Is that his name?
Barry Bonds was...
He was a steroid boy.
Yes.
There you go. I know one
His head size grew.
Okay. Anyway, let's carry on. So the ranking system was... So this is the big story. All right.
So let me help. The steroid era in baseball, the analogy here is the steroid era is the mid to late 1990s. And all of a sudden, we had these long-standing home run records that had not been broken in decades. Like Babe Ruth, we had all these records that were like decades. Roger Maris, home run, single season home run records. The number was 60 and then it was 61 and then nothing for decades. And then all of a sudden, we had five guys in the league at the same time going to 65, 68. And to Ian's point, their heads were gigantic.
I've seen the Simpsons episode, Ken Griffey.
Some of these guys were in their like 14th or 15th season. It was just inconceivable that they had doubled in size muscularly and they were cracking all the record books wide open. And eventually, of course, investigators found that there was a whole network of trainers and drugs and, you know, product coming in from Mexico and lies and depositions happened and it was a disaster. And I think it tarnished baseball for a really long time. And a lot of people that kids looked up to as heroes, you know, 10 years later, the kids grew up and they looked back at that and they said, oh, these guys were cheating. I don't think what's gone on in our industry has been cheating, but I do think that there have been some steroids in the mix. So the first thing that I bring up is the awards, the lists. Let me state this in a way that's not going to offend every single person listening.
Don't mince your words. No, offend away. Let's go for it. Let's see where we get to.
I am not saying that the scandal between RJ Shook's firm, Shook Research, and Forbes is the reason that any financial advisor got onto the list. Actually, nobody is saying that. These are two distinct things. The scandal is that RJ Shook had a partnership with Forbes. It helped him build his firm. He sold his firm to a private equity buyer. And as a thank you to the person at Forbes who was most influential in forging that partnership and keeping it going, he sent the guy, an editor at Forbes, $6 million.
Cool, $6 million. Yeah.
Nobody is saying that the guy, Randall Lane, was like manipulating the ratings because he was getting paid money. But it doesn't matter. What happened was an eruption in the advisor community and beyond about just the whole concept of these rankings and these lists and how do you get on it and how much of it is data and how much is subjective and how much of it is political and how much of it is I met so-and-so at a conference and okay. So that part of it is what pisses advisors off who don't get put on the list but feel that they deserve to be. So the eruption had nothing to do with the scandal. It was just
something that had been long simmering.
And the conflagration that grew out of that, you know, the New York Times wrote about it. It transcended our industry. But people are like, you know what? Fuck these lists.
And so do you
and
think
– And the award shows too. It's a toxic component of the business with people putting this stuff on their websites. And I joked, it's like I have a mug that says world's best grandpa. Therefore, I must be the world's best grandpa. I think that rubs advisors the wrong way. Unless you're one of the advisors that is actively campaigning and applying to be named to these lists.
So look, on a personal level, I think we can both agree we have our issues with awards and lists and things like that. And
what did you guys as journalists, what did you think of that revelation? Were you shocked or not really?
The $6 million payoff? I mean, look, as a journalist, I can tell you it's not a regular occurrence that someone writes you a check for $6 million. Yeah, it's really surprising. I think what's clear is, he wasn't involved. I have to be careful what we say here. I don't want to sort of, get into trouble. But yeah, it doesn't seem as if he was in any way involved in manipulating the list or whatever. It seems very much his role was in facilitating that arrangement, which was obviously incredibly lucrative for Shook, both prior to its sale, and then obviously it got its sale, and that was obviously a great thing for it. And obviously, I imagine it was very lucrative for Forbes as well, otherwise they wouldn't have continued to do it. And Forbes is a funny publication. It seems to go up and down, but its lists seem to be something that are consistently, it's consistently known for. Seems like a, yeah, I mean, it is shocking, isn't it? But I'm not really clear what it's for still, you know. It
sounds like exactly what they said it is, which is gratitude.
Yeah.
So he sold his research organization for a ton of money. And obviously that would not have happened if not for the partnership with Forbes, which is what put his research firm on the map as this sort of arbiter of like,
good and bad,
who are the best. And so it seems like exactly what they say. That part is the least suspicious part. It's like, hey, man, thanks for this partnership with Forbes. I really appreciate you being, you know, our advocate on the inside and keeping this going. And to show my gratitude, because we've been working together 15 years, here's $6 million.
I mean, yeah.
Which tells you how much money he must have gotten.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's also like, yeah, if you work in tech or you're sort of fund manager or whatever, and you get this, you see this kind of payoffs involved, you're like, okay, maybe that is like 6 months work for them, whatever. When you work in media, I can tell you that. I mean, that's your whole.
Well, what he should have done is, so what should have happened is Randall Lane should have said, I can't accept this money. However, I will be resigning from Forbes, giving 2 weeks notice, and I would be honored to, come work for you. And if that's the compensation that you would like to pay me, let's do it all out in the open.
Signing on bonus.
I'm not saying that would have gone over any better, but it would have been less of a conflict in the eyes of everybody else.
Yeah, it's huge, isn't it? And the impact already that we're seeing, we saw in the last couple of days, various of the large wirehouses, Morgan Stanley, Wells, saying, right, we're going to kind of like pull out of this. And then obviously Shook and Forbes had to kind of get ahead of that. And rather than having another like five firms say they're not going to be involved, they just said they're going to suspend the remaining events that they have and whatever rankings they have left for the year. So
they'll rebrand. The list will be back next year. Events will be back next year. The business will go on, and you will still have advisors spending $2,000 to buy a framed plaque where it says that they are the number 7 top advisor in Des Moines, Michigan. Iowa.
Yeah.
This
was going to be my counterpoint to you, which is like, you know, this isn't over. Like, yes, you're right. This has come out in the open, and yes, it might feed into a wider narrative you're making, but other people will fill the void. There'll be a new thing, and other advisors will pile into it. And I imagine they're still going to put it on their way. Like, I don't see that. And the credibility might be damaged. It might take a bump.
I think the sentiment around these rankings has sufficiently changed where, look, I saw last night the Edward Jones advisors are still posting this ranking, but they're probably the last to get the news. I think amongst the chattering class of advisors, it's sort of understood that this is embarrassing.
Does the client understand that though? Like, you know, do clients care about these things?
I think they do. I think clients don't understand this distinction that we just drew between Shook and Forbes and whether or not an advisor is on a list for the right reason. I don't think they understand that nuance. I just think this story became big enough that if an advisor is marketing themselves to you by saying I'm on this list, they're probably like, well, how'd you get on the list?
Okay.
So I think the sentiment may have turned against just this whole concept.
Okay, let's get to point two. Ian, this is very much your wheelhouse. So, Josh, your broad point here is rising rates will effectively the firms from or the current sort of, you know, roll-ups, et cetera, from doing 10 acquisitions a year with borrowed money. Ian, do you want to swing in on this? Or Josh, do you want to sort of, you know...
I'll let you go first, and then I have some commentary to add.
I'm just saying out loud what people are saying behind the scenes. This is very well understood and not at all controversial. In the steroid era, when you could borrow money, we had almost 0% interest rates for 15 years after the great financial crisis. And the economics were obvious. If you can borrow at LIBOR or now plus 2 points, or now it's SOFR, if you could borrow at SOFR plus 1, plus 2, and you could put that money to work into an asset class where cash flows are growing 15 to 20% a year, and multiples are growing, 10% a year. It's an arbitrage that is impossible to ignore. And as a result, we had this influx of 1,000 private equity firms and merchant bankers and investment bankers come in and figure out this is a really obvious thing that we can exploit. And they call it, quote, the arbitrage. And that terminology has become so widespread. I hired a lawyer last year for a completely unrelated thing that I was working on. And the lawyer asked what my business was. And I said, I'm an RIA owner. And he said, oh, are you doing any acquisitions? I said, no, not at the moment. He goes, but you're not doing the arbitrage? I said, what do you mean the arbitrage? He goes, you know, you buy a firm that's valued at 15 times cash flow, but you're bigger. So you're valued at 20 times cash flow. Instantly, you've just raised the value of your firm by 25%. I said, no, I'm not doing anything like that. He said, oh, okay. All my other clients are doing it. Everyone's doing it. So I understand. Everyone knows the problem is when the cost of capital goes up, all of a sudden, a lot of deals that looked great on a spreadsheet 3 years ago don't look as good. And then there's a whole other component to this with advisors trying to leave once the contract is up and not everybody got equity and firms becoming basically law firms with an advisory business attached and spending the preponderance of their time suing their own employees. There's a whole other – but a lot of the firms that are accepting awards at the galas and, you know, ranked number one in their whatever, it's not that M&A is all bad. But if you do 8 deals a year, don't tell me about the culture of your firm because you don't have one. And don't tell – right? If you've acquired enough businesses where you've imported 400 employees in the course of a year, don't tell me you have individually vetted all 400 of those employees and these are all people that you would bring home to dinner with your family. Stop it. Stop it.
So I have – Ian, do you want to come in? I've got one question on the rate stuff, but Ian, go first.
Yeah. So the one thing that you didn't mention is the leverage situation and how the credit markets actually view these firms, which I think is telling. And so, you know, I think because they're kind of esoteric, people don't realize that so many of these recognizable firms, Wellspire, Hightower, Creative Planning, Mariner, they have syndicated debt that trades publicly, whether it's notes or syndicated term loans. And so last week, we got Wellspire's numbers as part of an update, as part of their lender presentation. And so Wellspire...
which is what, very quickly, if people aren't familiar with it.
Massive RIA backed by Madison Dearborn Partners, north of, I believe it's around $612 billion in assets. That includes a lot of retirement stuff. But Wellspire was running for the second quarter of 2026 at a 30% EBITDA margin, 30.4%. On $45 million of EBITDA, $149 million in revenue. You know, 30% EBITDA margin for a firm of that scale, that's pretty good. Simultaneously, yeah, as to when that stuff came out, S&P downgraded Wellspire's overall corporate credit rating from B to a B-. And B- is firmly in the quote-unquote junk, high yield, however you want to frame it, territory. And it's because Wellspire was simultaneously issuing this tranche of unsecured notes, which S&P gave a triple C grade, which is one of the lowest you can possibly give. And the reason that they said that was because the note sale was expected to push Wellspire's leverage ratio, the ratio of its debt to its EBITDA, to as high as 10x earnings before settling at roughly 8x, 9x in 2027. And that's a leverage level that, you know, public companies just can't really operate under. If they do, they usually head for Chapter 11. I mean, Focus got hammered in the public markets consistently for trading at a 4x leverage ratio. And so for me, you know, I argue a lot of these firms have been trading in this higher interest rate environment for about 4 to 5 years now. But what we haven't really seen is what happens when there's a real actual market decline that lasts more than 2 quarters. Because in 2022, in the wake of some of the rising rates and the Ukraine war market shock, we saw a lot of these well-known private equity-backed firms take out these preferred equity deals that essentially function as payment in kind, which had like a interest rates effectively in the teens, 13 to 15%. Again, these are strategies that distressed companies used. And so my concern is when we see an actual real market slowdown, you might see one or two of these firms trip a covenant and have some sort of out-of-court restructuring and get taken over by its lenders. That's this kind of, you know, that's kind of like the whistling past the graveyard that I think we've had here the last 5-6 years.
What about the bull case, Freudian? You write about these.
Wait. So everything Ian said is so important because in the last, I think this is right, in the 15 years, or it's now 17 years since the great financial crisis, the S&P 500 has been compounding at like 12 to 13%. So against that backdrop, almost every deal works. Think about what you're doing. You're buying another firm's assets under management and its ability to build on those assets. The assets are going up. You have to be a complete idiot as an advisor to not have a portfolio that's higher today than it was 2 or 3 years ago. Right? So that's the backdrop. It's almost like, yeah, we're buying a business, but also the stock market is bailing us out every year, even if we manage it terribly, or if we can't grow organically, which of course they're all telling their backers, oh yeah, we're going to grow organically. The backer is like, oh, well, yeah, your revenue is up 12%. Great job. No, the stock market's up 20%. And the portfolios they manage are 60-40. Therefore, their growth is 12. That's not organic growth. That's market effects. And I know the money guys know this. That, you know, I'm not revealing anything, but it makes it really easy for everybody to look past. What happens after 2 years of no market growth? People forget that that's even possible. We really haven't had a recession since 2008. But let me tell you, I was in the business from 2000 to 2009. It was a lost decade for the S&P 500. You had two 50% crashes inside of a 7-year period during that decade, and the stock market average annual return was 0.0%. What do these businesses that are this highly levered, as Ian described, look like to the sponsors after a 2-year period? And you got to pay the interest rate. The meter's running. Now, there's also no buyers.
Well, okay, this was going to be my question. Where does this go? Yeah.
You're not going public. The public market chews these companies up and spits them out. They don't want them because there's a recognition that at a certain point, you run out of acquisitions.
Yeah, you've got to keep rolling up.
You start out buying, all right, these are the best 5 companies in the industry, RIAs. Let's buy these guys. They're awesome. Great. You buy 3 of them, another firm buys one, another firm buys. Okay, that's the 5 best. Who's next? Well, here's the next rung down, 10 firms. Some of these are like a boomer founder. They haven't organically grown in 15 years. Like, you know, some of these are like, hey, we used to be a broker dealer and we convert. So the quality starts to deteriorate. And then the roll-ups start buying smaller roll-ups. And then by the problem is the number of potential quality acquisitions vanishes, but you know what never goes away? The investor expectations. So now you're doing deals you would never have done, but you're forced to. How can you tell me that's a great firm?
And we've never really seen anyone do well on the, like you mentioned, Focus was there for a little bit. Something of a sort of earlier mover in this space.
They had to go private.
I can't really think of anyone else.
I'll give you another one. We have seen situations where public companies have kicked the tires on privately held RIAs. It almost never happens. Why do you think that is? Isn't that strange? Isn't it strange that we have RIAs now that are $500 billion under management, and not a single publicly traded financial services firm has closed an acquisition of one of them for exactly the reason that I described? Now, the fact that there's a lot of leverage and debt on them obviously makes it less palatable. But like, it's very strange to have this many gigantic private companies in our industry and no one in the public markets is doing those deals. The bankers are telling the would-be acquirers, no, you don't want to do that.
I know you had a sort of you wanted to give one positive case here, so let's try and do that very quickly because I'm conscious of time and I do want to get onto the last leg of jobs. Josh, do you still have time to do the last leg of the steroids post?
Yes,
on Schwab. Yep. Okay, you've got a minute on your bull case here. Well, are there some exceptions?
Well, actually, no. I'll kind of back you up a little bit here.
Okay,
we have seen one example, and that was the Goldman acquisition of United Capital.
And how'd that go? I was out sick that day.
And, you know, the part of it was that a lot of the advisors, they joined a company like United Capital because they didn't want to work for a firm like Goldman. And I think that we've seen that there's almost this kind of natural break or attrition as some of these firms scale up, that advisors break off and start their own firms. Like when we saw when Peter Malukin Creative, which is the firm I think could go public because they're arguably underlevered and have a clean capital structure, you know, the reason when we saw some of those advisors leave United Capital rather than go work for Peter Malouk, a lot of them went to hang up their own shingle as opposed to joining another established RIA.
Because they've done that. They've done that cycle before.
Peter Malouk is the guy that could break the cycle. I think he is the best entrepreneur in our industry. Like just the foresight, what he built, how early he was to it, how long he was able to hold on to it. And then – you know, ultimately he takes outside capital because at a certain point you need to take some of the personal risk off. And then he creates shareholders out of his employees. And I do think that he is the one of the mega firms who is the least roll-up-y. And I think that he does have the closest thing to a gigantic firm uniculture, monoculture, versus a lot of these firms where they're like, what do you want to do? 1099? Yeah, sure. You got it. You want to be W-2? Okay, that's great. You want to do alts? You don't. We don't care. Bring it. He's not doing that. I think he's buying advisors and hiring and training advisors, and they are becoming creative advisors. And he, to me, if I had to bet on who's going to do an IPO in this space that's well-received and people actually want to invest in, I think it's Peter. And I don't know who the second choice would even be.
Well, this, deliberately or not, is a neat segue from creative planning to referrals from a giant custodian, because that was at least initially
that was a major component of business
of their early growth. So let's pivot to your third point, Josh, on the why the steroid era for financial advisors is over, and this was about Schwab, as we discussed on the podcast last week. So regular listeners, you don't need us to recap this, but very quickly. In the space of 2 years, Schwab has moved the AUM threshold at which it would refer out brokerage clients to independent RIAs from 500,000 to 5 million at the start of 2027, which is a 10x increase for fans of math, or indeed maths, if you want to use the correct English. So, Ian, you have takes on this. We've discussed it a bit last week. You have a hotter take that you're going to bring to the table in a minute. But Josh, why does this feed into your thesis too?
Congratulations to the RIAs that have become $100 billion RIAs, because 15 years ago, they recognized this unbelievable opportunity, mostly in the Midwest, for some reason, and mostly in Kansas.
Kansas, yeah, which, there's a unicorn in
I'm waiting map. For somebody to explain it to me, but they nailed it. You had these discount brokerage custodians like Schwab, TD Ameritrade, and Fidelity. They had multimillionaires who needed very in-depth financial planning and advice, and in many cases, more customized asset management. And the firms that hit that early, it was an incredible thing. I think it helped the clients in most cases. I think it helped the brokerage custodians. And obviously, it helped the entrepreneurs who were RIAs onboarding those clients. And it worked great, and a handful of firms did it better than anyone else, and they have had enormous success. And no disrespect whatsoever, I think it's a really cool thing. Obviously, like all good things, people say, well, if that's good, wouldn't more be better? And wouldn't even more be even better? And you know, it rarely goes that way. So now you got all these firms that are basically their only growth, organic growth. It's renting clients from the brokerage custodians. Well, TD is gone, and that was a huge source of referrals, and that is now swallowed up by Schwab. And Schwab is effectively ending the program for sub $5 million referrals. And obviously, they're going to be less $5 million and up than there were $1 million and up. So they're winding it down. In the meanwhile, they took out a full page ad in the journal saying, we're going to hire thousands of internal financial consultants at Schwab who are going to take those accounts on in-house. And of course, it was always going to go this way. So if you were growing your business over the last 10 years using the steroids of rented clients from your custodian, I'm sorry, but that door is now closing and you're going to have to figure out how you're going to add your next 500 clients because they're not going to be coming from there. And this has been obvious to many of us in the industry for a long time. It's just now become acute because Schwab made a move. And I don't blame Schwab at all. They have a fiduciary obligation to their shareholders. And why are they giving 80% of the upside of these client relationships to a guy sitting in Kansas? Why would they be doing that at this stage in the game? So I think Schwab is doing what's best for Schwab. And I think advisors who have been living off of that now have to find new avenues for growth.
And Ian, we talked about this a lot last week. But yeah, I think you started to make a similar point to Josh, which is effectively this is the beginning of the end of that program,
yeah.
In your opinion.
Yeah, again, I know, shocker, I have an opinion on something. I don't think that this program will exist in 5 years. I think it'll be gone in 5 years.
Do you think like the other ones will still be around? Do you think everyone will follow suit? You know, obviously Fidelity's not a publicly traded company, but it will also look at this and go, well, why don't we do this? Why don't we keep more of the economics for ourselves as well?
Yeah, I think one thing to keep in mind here is that those two programs function a little bit differently. Fidelity has always been kind of kept pretty tight, and the way that Fidelity and Schwab are set, Schwab is much more dependent on the relationships that he build with local branch managers, whereas Fidelity, everybody's kind of on an even playing field.
Nationally.
So they don't function quite the same. And it's also worth noting that, you know, Schwab might be kind of slowly manufacturing consent to take this thing out. But at the same time, we've written about Pershing and Goldman trying to build up referral channels as well.
Which I still don't understand.
Robinhood as well.
And Robinhood, yes.
Yeah, from online clients though, yes. They obviously haven't got the physical branches. They haven't got the... I don't see it being quite as effective, but I don't know, obviously. So there will be some that exist. They obviously won't be as lucrative and as formative.
Guys, I met a financial advisor at Merrill Lynch, which is now Bank of America. And I asked him, you know, he's kind of struggling. I'm like, well, how do you add new clients? He said, well, my branch manager told me to go to like the local Bank of America branch in my town. Like there's three of them. So I each week I alternate, but I bring Dunkin' Donuts to like the guy sitting in the felt booth, the guy sitting in the cubicle. So he's like, I drop off donuts and coffee at a different one of the, and I'm like that. And then what happens? He's like, well, if they like me and they come across a client that they're not equipped to deal with, they might send it over my way. This is the way the world works. It's okay. There's nothing negative about it. It makes perfect sense. The problem is you have a lot of firms where they're sitting on panels at these conferences talking about their growth rate. And it's like, does nobody understand what's going on here? They're paying a rebate back to their custodian for the privilege of temporarily billing a customer that the custodian says is their client. Do you think Schwab for 1 second thinks an SAN advisor in their referral network has that as their client? No, it's Schwab's client. It was before and it'll be after. People do not move their money. So look, it's fine, but don't parade around beating your chest about your organic growth. It's not organic. You're buying clients. You're not even buying them. It's a lease.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So look, I'm conscious of time, Josh, and you've been very, very generous with your time. And thank you very much for going through all of this. So to recap, lists aren't going to do the business for you anymore in terms of referring clients. The cat's out of the bag. That's point one. Point two, M&A is going to be harder and harder and harder, and there's no end point for you if you keep doing that. So that growth avenue sort of starts to close off too. And then your third point, if you've been relying on these three things for growth, lists and the credibility that brings you, M&A, but in this interest rate environment, which will be changing, and referrals from large custodians, those avenues are restricting, and thus that's the end of the steroid era. That's the end of easy-ish money for advisors.
The really great news, in this ecosystem, we have 18,000 RIAs. Out of that 18,000, there are probably 2,000 or 3,000 that are amazing. So Future Proof is in a couple of weeks out in Huntington Beach, California. I don't know the exact total registrations. I'm told it's north of 5,000, which is completely outrageous. I think last year was like 4,300 or 47. I forget what the exact. It's filled with up and coming, energetic, creative entrepreneurs in our industry, and they are some of the most amazing people I've met in 29 years on Wall Street. They are going to figure out their own organic growth strategies, and they are crushing it. And nobody needs the steroid era. The firms of the future that you guys are going to be covering for the next 20 years, most of them you haven't even met yet or heard of. And you're going to hear these stories like, whoa, that firm just went from $1 billion to $5 billion. And how did they do it? And it's not going to be because they made 27 acquisitions. And it's not going to be because they're buying clients from somebody else. Like, you're going to hear unbelievably creative stories about organic growth in our space. And I love this industry. And I feel as though I'm part of a community, and I really care about the health of the community. And so I think this is ultimately a good thing. Firms getting back to basics and putting the needle down.
Fantastic. Also, massive respect, Josh, for waiting 53 minutes before dropping a Future Proof plug. I mean, that is admirable dedication.
The restraint is Herculean.
Phenomenal work. Josh, thank you so much. We invited you on for 30 minutes to talk about your take. You've given us a lot more than that. We've run through all of Altruist. We've got an inside opinion on that. So that's brilliant. Ian, before we go, anything you wanted to add?
No, I mean, I just think, he's called it the steroid era. I've called it kind of the age of decadence.
Okay.
We'll see which one sticks.
But they're both, you have said that before.
I like that too.
Similar takes. Ian, just nipping in there at the end to say, I had this take too. Ian, thank you as ever. Josh, thank you very much indeed. Listener, thank you very much indeed. And we will be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.